Hello. Oh. Hello. Good morning and welcome to the panel for the hardcore audiences.
We'll remember to reset their watch.
Yeah, hardcore. This is Hollywood in hardcore. So hats off to those of you who have actually made it on a Sunday morning at 10 o'clock in daylight savings time at South by Southwest. My name is Evan Hirsch. I'll be your moderator today. The panel is as titled. What we've got is a terrific panel in front of you. On my right is Joe Crump, who I'll do introductions later, but is representing the writers in the room. Lisa Ronan is a producer. Next to Lisa is Raziz Spell, who is an information architect and pretty just all-around smart guy. And Marty Klein's an art director. What we're going to do, just give you a heads up so you know how we're going to work this morning, is we will do some short videos. We're going to show you some stuff. Then I'll let you do each panel make a statement and show you a few minutes of work. I'll have some questions for the panel, and then we're going to open it up to you folks. What was interesting for me was when Chris asked me to fill in for him on the panel, and I also want to say thanks to Chris Bernard for getting things so organized. What was interesting for me is that it's really been an interesting year. You know, the conventional wisdom in a lot of entertainment was, you know, more of this, more of that, meaning more killing, more blood, more violence, more mayhem. And in technology, it was more polygons, more pixels, more complexity. And then the Wii came out and told us all that we were upside down, backwards, and wrong, that actually people want less and simplicity. And then the iPhone has furthered that. And we're seeing a lot of web interfaces that further that as well. And then I'm currently involved on Surface, which is what I like to call barrier-free computing, although that's not a publicly approved statement. But it just allows you to reach out and touch something and move it. And interestingly enough, in this morning's Sunday New York Times was a nice little article in business section about getting people closer to directly touching the information. So I think what's interesting about this panel is that there's an array of people up here who've worked in different aspects of it, such as Marty, who has been instrumental in many films in deciding what that future would look like, to people like Joe and Raziz on the cutting edge of how we actually do that in the real world. I was at the American Film Institute's DigiFest back in November, and I got to see a talk by Marshall Herskovitz, who I believe is doing a talk at 5 o'clock on Tuesday on Quarterlife. And despite what happened on the NBC outing of it, it was never meant for TV. And what was interesting about it was, you know, Marshall was talking about, here's a pretty accomplished guy. He was the director of, the producer-writer of 30-something in My So-Called Life. The guy's got a bit of a track record. He was explaining that he can't get his scripts written without getting notes from people who just used to work in the mailroom. And that's pretty much what the Hollywood model has resorted to. And it was very interesting. So he decided to write a series for the internet. And I don't want to paraphrase him. I don't want to represent him. But my take on it was, because he wants to be able to communicate directly to his audiences without going through many intermediaries. And here's a guy whose resume is, again, My So-Called Life and 30-something, amongst other things. So what his whole policy was, he wanted to self-fund it so he could be creatively in control and have the final cut. But what was really interesting, he was explaining, was that he's got a bunch of, 20-somethings in his office that are in a whole different technology space than he is. So what he wanted to do with Quarterlife was fascinating, was have this community around it that participates in it. So I thought that was also an interesting point of the democratization of entertainment, but how somebody at a very high level is working on it across levels. And again, when you start thinking about that, we're going to show you the opening trailer from, we're going to start with a trailer from Quarterlife. And what's really fantastic about it is here's, you know, people with blogs and ideas like that thinking about their lives, and then that's winding its way into storylines. And again, so we've got culture influencing entertainment, influencing culture. So what we're going to do is we'll start with the Quarterlife trailer, and then we'll play you a little montage to get your minds thinking about some of the juxtaposition of what's going on between entertainment and popular culture and technology, and then we'll move on through the panel. So with that said, let's move into the video. Oh, no, you just realized we have no audio output. Do we have audio? My apologies for that.
We're going to have to switch back over to this machine.
Hey, you know what, then, Lisa?
Do you want to
wait? Yeah, you just keep it there, then. Here.
We'll keep it there. We're going to just...
Just put it for a second. Okay.
Okay.
We need to do the video switch.
why do we blog? We blog to exist. Therefore, we are idiots.
Dylan is blogging about us.
What the hell do you think you're doing?
What are you talking about?
You know damn well what I'm talking about. You put my face all over the frickin' net.
You told me that I had to write what moves me.
It moves you to destroy people's lives? Yeah, that's what
right.
moves
it's just
you?
That I have to be honest. You know that. I'm sorry. It's like a fetish or something.
A sad truth about my generation is that we were all geniuses in elementary school, but apparently the people who deal with us never got our transcripts because they don't seem to be aware of it. It's my curse that I can see what people are thinking, what they want to say and can't say, who they want to be with, and what good does that do me if nobody can see me?
So I would encourage you to just check out their website. Their community site is quite interesting, what they've done and how they're trying to take ideas and bring it in. And now what we'll do is we're going to just swap over to a clip we've put together just, again, to just kind of spur some thinking about how Hollywood and culture and literature have been going back and forth to influence each other. This is just more meant to be a fun look at some things.
Everybody remember where we parked.
Large mushroom pepperoni with extra onions, please. What is that?
What's wrong?
You have a pocket pager. Are you a doctor?
What is it? I thought I told you never to call me.
Beam us up, Mr. Scott.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that. This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
Damn.
Now, from what I can see, we got a white male victim, about 5'10", approximately 170. And it takes a round in the 10 ring and goes out a window.
Red ball?
Nope.
Brown ball.
This one's premeditated.
Amazing.
Thank you.
So our first panelist is Razis Spell. Razis is a computational scientist with an expertise in informational visualization and information architecture. He's the senior consultant of lead interaction developer at Round Arch. He has a PhD in biomedical engineering from Duke, where he was focused on computational biology. His doctoral research developed novel information visualization approaches. I have to read this. I'm sorry. For comparative genomic sequence analysis. And as I've been joking with the panel, here's a man who actually has worked on genome modeling as opposed to people like me who've just said, oh, that would look a cool way to do genome modeling on a screen. He was at Accenture in their technology labs, an effective UI group. He's led projects developing visual analysis for the defense, intelligence, and healthcare industries. And currently he's doing software architecture, where he's working on rich internet applications for digital media and the finance industries. So with that, I'll turn this over to Razis.
Thanks. Is that on? All right. Here we go. All right. So I'll just start off with a short video, just kind of sticking with the theme and format of the panel. This is sort of setting the stage for what I want to talk about. Pretty short video there, and I'll promise I'll tie it in. I'm not introducing another metaphor into this panel of that's kind of overlapping with them right now. But basically, I had to have a video too, right? So I'm pretty much the. Oops, wrong one. I hate when it steals your joke, right? That's terrible. Hold on a second. Let me see if I can. Going to mirror the display. See that? See if that works a little better. All right. Hopefully the resolution is not too bad mirroring the display. So when Chris had the idea for this panel and introduced it to me and asked if I'd want to be a part of it, sounded great. Like it really applies to kind of my approach and how I've done things in my work, namely borrowing metaphors from other creative industries and tracks and applying them to my own work. And then a few months later, he calls me back and says, oh, this is the panel we have lined up. We've got some really great people. And he starts listing the people. And the first thing that comes to mind is like, what the fuck am I doing on this panel? Are you kidding me? Like, what, like, and you hear some of the bios of the people and I'm like, all right, whatever. And so, a couple months ago I was vacationing, in Ibiza, and I was talking to Tommy C and W, you know, Tom Cruise and Will Smith. And I was like, you know, when I get on the panel, I guess I'm just gonna have to name drop so I fit in with these guys and try to sort of de-nerdify myself. So as part of that, this morning, I'm laying in bed and I'm kind of like, you know, wow, the gravity of the situation kind of dawns on me. I had dinner with these guys, really great folks. And, you know, they're talking about the different stuff that they've done. And I'm like, well, you know, I'm definitely out of my league here. So, you know, how am I going to tie all this stuff together? And so I came up with the standard sort of a joke intro, right? And so this is sort of, this to me kind of ties us all together in this weird way. So, you know, what we in academia would call research, and now in industry as a consultant, what I call leveraging is pretty much what designers and creative people call inspiration, right? And it's this idea of looking to other people and finding out how they've solved problems and the constraints that they operate within, and then sort of the creative birth that comes from their problems, their particular problems and constraints. And so it just sort of as an example kind of like past stuff that I've done where at a total loss and then sort of like where I was able to sort of take my work by leveraging other people's ideas is so as Evan said, I was a computational biologist in graduate school and I in the engineering side, and I go over to the genetics lab, and the first day the guy who ended up being my advisor says, you know, we're doing these genome analysis, right? And really the problem that I'm having is I have an Excel spreadsheet with 25,000 lines and they all represent genes and gene positions. And I have no way to make sense of this. And so that was my supposed to be my summer project, ended up being my dissertation project. And really kind of the light bulb moment, I was in Boston at a conference and this really sharp guy, Martin Wattenberg, and you've probably seen some of his visualizations online, came up with this thing called a way of visualizing repetitive patterns in songs. And so I'm sitting in the talk and I'm like, wow, that's amazing. You know, music is just a sequence of notes, and the genome is the way we model it, at least, is a sequence of letters. And so, you know, is there a way where I can kind of leverage this visual metaphor to help present information to biologists and analyze genomes? So what I came up with was, fortunately, the resolution is a little bit bad, is this interactive tool called biological arc diagrams. And so this is kind of a mess comparing some data. We're just going to call it data, right? But by interacting and starting to analyze and work with the tool, even to the layperson, what you see here is repetitive structure. You see on top this thing that I call the seagull effect, and then beneath the axis you see this kind of chaotic, and what that's representing is evolution in this particular region of the genome. And then with a little more filtering, what you start to see is things like this, where you can isolate on a particular region and you see these really nice organized patterns. And what this is showing is a conserved region in the genome, and there's some other potential biological significance. So, you know, there's an example going from music to biology. And so my hypothesis in terms of who inspires who is that it's really a two-way street. There's a them and an us, and we all have problems and we have some constraints, and those constraints take different forms. And then what comes out of that is some product, right? Some type of solution. And the inspiration goes both ways. And so as an example, some direct inspirations, we have a problem. How can I visualize 3 billion letters, right? And then the constraint is 3 billion. I mean, 3 billion letters, you don't have 3 billion pixels on your screen. So already we're operating in inside of not even a metaphorical box, but a real box, right? The screen. And so one of my colleagues, Ben Fry, really, really brilliant guy, came up with this visualization called the genome valence. And the genome valence was actually a visual used in the Minority Report and the Hulk. Here's a screenshot of the genome valence. And I should also add as a side note, when I first met Ben and saw this, I was kind of realized that I was kind of out of my league and as far as like visualizing genomes. But I also learned another important thing that started to surface a couple years ago as my career kind of went different directions, which is basically like make good looking stuff, man. If you make good looking stuff, like who really cares about the data? That's not really all that important. And so here's an example of the genome valence in the Minority Report. Here's an example of the genome valence being visualized in the Hulk. So I'm kind of speed up here because I don't want to take too much time. But basically, this is a quote by Igor Stravinsky summarizing constraints and the creative birth that can come from constraints. As an example, across the different tracks that we're talking about here. So we all have this problem where we need to produce things, right? And we have varying constraints. So in this example of literature, here are some examples of constraints. So 30 days. So in 30 days, we're going to introduce a time constraint. Lipograms, where you produce a literary work where you omit a letter. Belle Absinthe, where you create a literary work where you don't use any, I believe it's you don't use any word that's in another text. And then centos, which is really just basically plagiarism. You create a work from existing works, right? And then from this, we get literature. And the example of the 30 days is actually a group called NaNoWriMo that my wife participated in. And think it's National Writers Month in November, and in 30 days you're supposed to create a novel. It's like 50,000 words, and they have this whole online community built around it. It's really, really pretty interesting. So film, kind of, 365 days is the time constraint. And then Susan Laurie Parker in Chicago came up with 365 plays, where she wrote a play a day, and then these plays were performed, I believe, in 2006 by a variety of theaters around the country. And so then in design, a recent example that I came across on the plane a few weeks ago is that 100 days, and this guy, Martino Gamper, a furniture designer, had 100 chairs in his studio, and he came up with 100 different new chair designs in 100 days. And so that's his product, right? So just an example of this process between the three different tracks. So that's basically it. Hope I didn't take too much time.
That was a whole session. That was great.
Thanks for coming. Thanks, Rosies. So Marty Klein on the end, he's an art director I've recently had the pleasure of starting to work with. Marty started as a model builder at Disney at Epcot, and he's also worked on Fantasyland, which I just realized this morning. I just love the fact that I can now hold up. See, Marty actually can go to Fantasyland. He's a quite accomplished visual effects art director. He was a visual effects art director on Beowulf, Polar Express, Spider-Man, and Contact. He was a first unit art director on Jurassic Park and Forrest Gump. And he's worked with Robert Zemeckis on films such as Who Framed Roger Rabbit and Back to the Future, all three parts of that, parts 1, 2, and 3, I guess is the better way to say that. He's also done theme park design in Tokyo. So he's a man of great wealth of experience, and he's now working with us on Surface. He also is talking about information visualization. He's taught storyboarding to the Directors Guild of America and the Directors Guild of Canada. And he's also the vice president of the Illustrators and Matte Artists Union. So he's got a very interesting and different perspective. And with that, I'll turn it over to Marty Klein.
Thank you. Thank you. Can you hear me? Is our technology working yet? Hello? Closer. Technology. Closer and closer. And then we'll get the hum. Yeah. I'm sure they had it right when I started, and now I'm screwing it up. I don't have a lot of wonderful presentation videos to show you. It's mostly films that you've seen. You guys have been out there and you've been watching all the movies that we all watch and some of the movies that we make. The point I wanted to make to begin with was that in terms of who inspires who, I think that what we're really talking about is, what makes compelling experiences, compelling media for us, what makes something just an interesting thing to do. Because ultimately, no matter what we're doing here, it's always come down in every project I've worked on and every movie I've worked on to story. So the three most important things in making a movie are story, story, and story. And everything else belongs to supporting that. And I think that one of the things we're talking about here is not so much will we find new stories to tell or new things to put up, but it's really going to be a question of how do we find new ways to put across the same old stories. I won't speak for the writing segment of this, except to say that a lot of people agree there are only, 7, 12, 15 stories to be told in humankind. And most of what we're doing is telling those stories over and over again and finding new ways to make them compelling to people, to make them interesting to people, to get people involved. The clip we had from Quarter Life looked to me very much like a movie with a bunch of editing in it, but the idea of structuring that so it appeals to people who have experience with online media, who have experience with blogs, who have experience with the camera in the top of their laptop so they can interact with people, is a way of making the same story about people's lives and how difficult and interesting they are, a way of making that appeal to people who have a different day-to-day experience than maybe I do, that are more involved online, that are more involved with contemporary media. So what I wanted to show for a clip was, in essence, how no matter what our issues are for inspiration, we're dealing with the same stuff over and over again. So this is a little clip out of, let's go to the head of it. Is that good? It's thinking. All right. So this is from Children of Men. You guys may remember this scene. They're escaping with a pregnant girl. They're being thwarted by a bunch of bad guys. What's happening here is, it's one of those post-apocalyptic futures. Things have gone to hell, and we're worried about it. We're trying to escape. Now, what they've done that's really interesting in this, from a technical standpoint, was they brought the camera inside the car. So for this entire scene, you're staying inside the car in a way that you really can't really can't do. You can't get a huge camera full of film inside a car without doing some pretty nasty tricks. This involves, in this one, taking off the roof of the car, replacing it digitally, sometimes replacing background outside, editing things. But what one of the points I wanted to make as a sidebar, though, just starting from the beginning, look in the lower right corner. If it wasn't for that stuff on the screen, this could be something taking place in a movie in 1990, 1970, 1950. Same action. But throwing that little stuff in the corner is the designer's way of telling you that, reminding you that we're in the future. This is not, a 52 Ford that they're escaping in. This is a car with a heads-up display on the screen. And one of the things we tend to do as designers is to try and put a lot of things in the background that add to the experience and tell you things that you wouldn't be able to get. You would get a different way in another medium. If this was literature, we'd be listing all the things that were happening here, one after another. And depending on the writer, they'd be writing them in a different structural order. But it's movies, so we've decided exactly what you should be looking at any given moment. And what we're doing then is trying to just say, well, look at the kind of people coming down the hill, and my job as a designer is to tell you what they should be carrying. AK-47s, heavy weapons, rocks and sticks. What should they be carrying that tells you something about the nature of these people? And that's all something the audience picks up subliminally. You just get it. You know where you are, and you understand it from other experiences you've had of what kind of people these are attacking the car. But principally, I mean, we put this up to talk about this kind of technology, using visual effects, digital compositing, various green screen technologies, new camera technology. We can make you feel like you're right inside the car with them. You're in between two people you couldn't even fit in between if you were really sitting there, because there's people in the front passenger seat too. So as comparison to that, what I wanted to do was show you how long they've been working on this technology business. So I got a little thing here. I want to see if we can get into the right place. One of the things about who inspires who, to me, is that almost everybody thinks that they can take something from another medium and move it into their own. So we make movies from novels. We make comic books from novels. We make novels from comic books, and we keep going back and forth in all those directions. And the reason is not because we're waiting for it to finally find the best medium to display it in. The reason for doing that is because the artist doing the work thinks, this is someplace where I can actually contribute my own vision to what's going on here. So what I wanted to throw in now was an old Alfred Hitchcock movie. So 60 years ago, we can essentially say Hitchcock is doing the exact same thing.
There's too much hair in your glass.
This is a film called Rope.
Don't mind, fine, thanks. Would you mind taking this into Janet?
Was his first color film. And as a result,
particular reason, it's hers. I thought you'd like
what he was
to
doing, he was
it.
Taking a stage
She's
play
in the bedroom,
and trying to produce
then you'd
it
like David to walk
cinematically. So it all takes place in this room for an hour and a half, and we find ourselves doing things
really
like this.
From
at this moment, the reason we're looking at that is that guy's back, which seems like a very strange camera move to anybody who's cinema literate. What he's doing there is he's actually stopping the camera on the guy's back and changing film. We shot this in 10-minute segments because the camera could run 10 minutes of film. Now, you also have to understand that this is almost exactly like the Children of Men sequence in that he has a camera in a space that the camera really overwhelms. A three-strip Technicolor camera is about the size of a major household appliance. It's two refrigerators side by side on a camera platform. And to move this thing around and get it into looking at these people, we can stop there. Unless you're actually watching it, it's all dialogue. It's all about people's performance and about this idea of moving together. And what he's done here is tried to find a way to bring it to the stage, shoot in color, and use the technology he had. And one of the biggest fears the actors had in this movie was that because he's moving two refrigerators through the scene into close-ups and everything, that they've moved furniture out of the way. And in trying to put things back, the next thing they do is worry if the chair they're supposed to sit on will be there when the camera moves back, because somebody has to remember to put the furniture back as the camera moves through the scene. So I'm probably running on too. We tend to do that. The point is, they've been doing this kind of technology informs media for a lot more than the last 5-10 years. I'm sorry, I don't want to overwhelm everybody. So
no, that's good.
Moving
Thank you.
On.
Thanks, Marty.
Thank you. So next up will be Lisa Sanders, who's the founder of the Ronin Group. She's the producer representative of us today. She founded the Ronin Group, which is a management consulting entity that works on business strategy and operations for technology and entertainment companies. She also they also do producing of digital content for a variety of clients. She's currently working with Microsoft Game Studios and Microsoft Surface as a consultant and executive productress, as I like to refer to her. She was previously at Sony Pictures ImageWorks as the executive director of digital production, and also she was the executive director of special projects at Sony Pictures Digital Studios. She's done some time in Tokyo at Sony's technology center there, and prior to Sony, she was also at Disney in London as a marketing and publicity person, and she actually started in the film business as a location manager, we learned last night, which was kind of fun. So with that, I'll turn it over to Lisa.
Okay, I'm going to try and do this without the hum, too. Be near. Okay. I just put together just about four or five conceptual slides because what I want to talk about a little bit today is traditional Hollywood and how that fits with the interactive landscape right now. And what I've done over the past couple of weeks is gone out and talked to some actual independent producer friends of mine about, you know, what their attitudes are right now with regard to interactive entertainment, how it's or just, you know, the interactive landscape of our lives and how that's influencing feature production slates or, you know, how they option material, because I think that that's, you know, that's a sphere of influence, as you will, as, in terms of how things work back and forth, as Razeez was talking about. So let me go first to this. Just to touch again on a lot of what Marty was just talking about is the visual language of the filmmaker. I think that this is where the most visible influences of the interactive world are showing up in feature film production. You know, in camera, you know, movement, perspective, and framing. I mean, I think you saw a lot of that in the intro reel where, you know, things look like in-game cameras, you know, with the Spider-Man footage and things like that. You know, you're following things around as you would sort of in-game. Things are framed as you might see them on a game console often. Art direction, graphics, lighting, environments. And one thing that surprised me is that there are some producers out there that really feel like interactive entertainment is influencing editorial style right now. And that that there's a lot of quick cutting and juxtaposition that's being used to sort of create the illusion of, you know, of action, similar to the way people experience it when they're gaming. So I just talked about a couple of these things, but production design, you know, we're seeing a lot of high-tech looks, you know, based on, you know, whatever the script, you know, demands, user interfaces that show up on screen a lot, camera movement, perspective, shooter, POVs, God's eye views, you know, which I think we saw a lot in the reel as well, and blocking and choreographed action that looks a lot like game characters. Physical environments, battlefields, virtual worlds, these are all things that we accept now. And so what we're really thinking about is a cultural frame of reference that interactive entertainment is providing now in the feature film environment. People generally accept and will weave these things into a story is sort of a plot point, an enabling vehicle in the story, multiplayer environments, handhelds, touch screens, and then also, you know, when you're trying to put something out there that really represents future think, it really shifts with the things that are now possible. So if you look at, you know, Kirk and Spock and, you know, the communicator that flips open like a Motorola Razr, you know, you know, before that was just so far out there. And now it's like, well, of course he's Spock's on a cell phone. So that really, you know, creates some real demands on writers' imaginations as everything keeps marching forward beyond what we can experience now. One of the things that I talked to a producer about this week was the whole element of youth culture. And how that's really permeating things right now. Interactive media is a lifestyle, youth's attachment to devices and platforms. And these are showing up more and more on screen and in story is something that we accept. And it actually helps move the action forward. It's not there for its own sake. It's there because it's a common frame of reference that we have. Also, the mixed martial arts wave, you're seeing a lot of that you know, on screen as well. So from the perspective of the producer, and when I say the producer, I would mean, you know, the development executive at a major studio, the independent producer or independent production company, people who are receiving scripts and commissioning treatments. They're really, and then also acquiring properties. There's, you know, everybody understands that there's a migration of creative properties across platforms. You know, they're looking, successful interactive properties like Halo and others, obviously get optioned, but they don't always get made, but they always get a look. They're originating from other material, the graphic novels. You know, I showed you a lot of Sin City in the front reel, in the front of the reel, and that those have sort of a stylized game ready look. And again, increasing acceptance because people are used to seeing that kind of visual imagery more and more. So again, here's Marty's point, story, story, story. We see a lot of interactive game-focused storylines, you know, going back over the past 10 years, really. I mean, even in, you know, things like, you know, the game properties that have migrated, but also, you know, things like Existence. I was watching an old David Cronenberg movie the other day where people are actually ported into these bioports in their back, and then they hold these game consoles. It's a crazy movie, but you know, those things can keep popping in over and over again. And then something I call the waking dream, which is the illusion of consciousness when one is really not, or the illusion of being placed in an environment or in a world that's real, which is really not. And I think that that's been thematic and you know, continues to be. Okay, so here's the heresy right here. And I think Joseph may have some disagreement with this, but this is one school of thought in Hollywood right now. And it may represent, you know, some resistance to and backlash against sort of the whole interactive entertainment wave. And it's the fact that a creative property is interactive does not necessarily make it instantly appealing or an instant starter for a Hollywood producer. It's really about story for them. They're still very much grounded in a very traditional narrative type of mindset. They come to the theatrical film platform with a set of expectations. And I think we have to start thinking about our movie theaters as a platform, just like your handheld's a platform or the internet's a platform. And they want to be led through the narrative by the filmmaker, that's the experience they expect. So whether or not that's true, I think that it's going to be interesting to see the way that plays out over the next 5 years or so, you know, as the boomers age and as, you know, the Gen X and Gen Y come flooding in and making their way of experiencing content more relevant. What I would argue is that I don't think we'll ever see movie theaters disappear, because there's a common, seems to be a human need for a shared experience in a dark movie theater. You know, how much of that constitutes the entire entertainment media consumption landscape, I think, is a real question in the future. So that is.
Okay, and last but certainly not least is Joseph Crump. He's the executive creative director for Avenue A Razorfish in the Northeast, based in New York City. He has 25 years of experience, and he's responsible for all of the creative work coming out of Razorfish in the Northeast. His current clients include Universal Music, CNN, L'Oreal, Condé Nast, the New York Times, Ralph Lauren, and the TED Conference, which is always an impressive thing to see. Previously, he was the principal at the Dublin Group and was the executive creative director at the Spiegel Group. And what I find interesting, he's also done a fair amount of writing for things such as Playboy, Smithsonian, Outside, and Esquire, so it's quite a range. He's a member of the International Academy of Digital Arts and Sciences, and he spends his time between homes in Rio and New York, so it tells you the life of a writer isn't always bad. So with that, I'll turn it over to Joe.
How fabulous for me. we were taking bets earlier on who could use the phrase first, blank, you ignorant slut. So, Lisa, you ignorant slut.
ding, 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 ding.
Exactly. So as you've heard, I'm a writer. I write for books. I write for magazines. I've written for television. And most recently, I write for the web quite a lot. And so what I thought I would do during my little three-minute spiel here is to trot out kind of a theory. And you can call bullshit on me if you disagree. So my theory is that people are changing, and actually they're changing really, really fast, faster than we could possibly have predicted. And entertainment is changing as well. And So let me just cite, even though I'm a creative guy, I will cite a couple of facts. So fact one, 60% of people today are watching television while they're online and vice versa. So the idea of a nuclear family, or frankly, anyone at all who's sitting back and watching anything that you're producing with any sort of soul focus is really a, kind of a dead concept. Fact two, traffic to magazine websites as opposed to print magazines has increased 400% in the last year and a half. So print is having a problem. Now, I was raised as a journalist and worked in magazines for a million years, and people have been predicting the death of magazines for as long as I've been in the business. I don't suspect that that's happening, but what I do see happening there is an interesting precursor, which is that people are seeking out content that they love, but they're seeking it out in fundamentally different places. Fact three, social networking is increasing. It's the fastest increasing form of entertainment, period, globally. So 70% of people right now are visiting social networking sites every single day. 65,000 videos are uploaded every single day. 100 million videos are watched every single day, all online. By the year 2010, more than half of the video content consumed online will be user generated. Setting aside whether it's going to be good or not, it's going to be user generated. So my thesis here is that storytelling, though I really believe in stories passionately with all my heart, I believe that storytelling is not keeping pace with these changes. The Hollywood writer strike is maybe the most recent example of this, that there is something fundamentally wrong with the machine in Hollywood that's producing stories and its failure to keep up with the way the world has evolved. Once upon a time, storytelling was simpler, right? You know, beginnings, middle, and ends. You know, as Marty said, there are really only 7, some people say 12, some people say 15 types of stories in the world. I actually agree with that. But I think that the advent of technology and the changes in human behavior really force us to rethink what story is when it comes into this very, very different and interactive medium. So this all made me wonder that it can't be true that all bets are off. Like, there have to be some things that we can learn from the fact that stories have been being told and made since people learned to speak and communicate. So this is my hypothesis, is that going forward, as people who create stories and people who make money from the creation of those stories, we need to think of stories as platforms. And the way that those platforms will live will depend largely on the audience. And I'd like to suggest that going forward, you can think about the world in terms of 3 different audiences. So I think there are people who watch, and those people are going to feel and behave very similarly to the people that you imagine, I think, are currently watching your work. They're just going to want to watch it. And I think going forward, there are also people who really are going to want to share your work. Now, there are a lot of people in between those people and content, and a lot of them are lawyers. And so the fact is that I think this feels to me like an inexorable force. People are going to want to share the content that you produce, and they will, whether you want them to or not, or whether the Supreme Court will want them to or not. They will share your content. So my advice is that we, as people who create that content and create the platforms where that content need to live, need to get used to that fact and, in fact, really, really embrace it. And the third group is people who are going to want to create content themselves, perhaps with the content that you built to begin with. So I'm going to go through very quickly some examples of places where this is happening. Because this is South by Southwest, I suspect, highly educated audience, you've seen the majority of these, so I'll go through fairly quickly. So places where watchers go. I think that, you know, though most of us really dream that we're going to create content that's going to cause people to sit back in their chair in a dark room and pay attention, honestly, not happening. Good goal to have, but it's a myth. So these are the places increasingly where your content is going to end up. So here you see Hulu, Juice, Neve, and Mania TV. I would encourage you, if you haven't, to check them all out, because this is where your content is going to end up, whether you want it to or not. The second group, this is where the sharers hang out, right? So remember earlier I said that basically 7 out of 10 people are currently going to social networking sites every day, amazingly. 100 million people are watching videos every single day. They're going to be watching them in venues like this, which at their heart allow them not just to watch, but to actually play with the videos, comment on them, to share them, to create social networks around that content. Incredibly powerful phenomena. And these are just two of dozens of sites like this that exist currently. So this is break.com and dailymotion.com. Again, I would encourage you to check them out. And this last group, the creators, again, the smallest group, maybe the most important, because they're the ones who create the content that's going to end up being watched by the first group and played with by the second group. So here are two sites, Metacafe and Jump Cut, that really give people actually quite powerful tools to mess with your content, to mash it up, to remix it, to use it as ingredients in their stories. Very, very, very powerful phenomenon. So there are a lot of reasons why you should not pay attention to anything that I've just said. Here are three really good ones. Lawyers, not my favorite people. Ego, which is honestly, I think, actually the thing that's been driving the profound absence of progress in coming out of Hollywood. And technology, which is, for a lot of us, a barrier, right? It requires some facility with technology in order to be able to actually grab this particular bull by the horns and begin to innovate within it. So I would encourage you to, you know, either steer clear of lawyers or get one yourself. You know, really try to figure out a way to override that incredible impulse that we all learned in art school, which is that our goal in life is to create one perfect thing that's going to get launched and exist in the world as a glorious gem. And to get more familiar with technology, because going forward, it is a part of the landscape. And of course, you don't have to do any of this, but I would suggest that if you don't, your audience is going to. Thanks.
Thank you. Do people have questions? Because we only have about 8 or 9 minutes left, and I had some ones planned, but maybe I'll let you guys start. There's a microphone back there. We'll just go right to the audience questions then.
Hi. You guys have all talked about every single burning question I've had. I'm a graduate certificate screenwriting student at Emerson College in Boston. I have 2 kids graduated from film school. The interesting thing is my son is now working at a startup called Telex, TELLX.com, which is interactive DVD movies. Their tagline is "Touch the movie." And when I explain that to all of his friends or people who work for me who are about his age, they get very excited. They think it's very cool. When I explain it to my friends, they don't get it. And, you know, I'm wondering, as somebody who's going into the industry, don't you think we're creating 2 completely different markets? I know you said 1 story, 3 audiences, but I don't think we've had a place in history where we've had 2 strong consumer cohorts, demographics right now. The Gen XYs, the quarter lifers, and the baby boomers. And I don't think there's anything, personally, I can't visualize it, help me, that's going to cross over. I feel like we're creating 2 separate markets, one that appeals to the baby boomers and one that appeals to the younger generation.
Baby boomers are all going to be dead.
Well, that's kind of bleak.
I would throw out the Wii as a perfect counterexample, right? The Wii, everyone plays the Wii, my step-parent. But what I'm saying, the popularity of that console crosses multiple generations, from children to boomers to, you know, my mother and stepfather, I mean, instantly gravitated towards, my in-laws gravitated towards it. You know, so there are some examples where that is not the case.
Yeah, I think that what you're going to see is a mix based on demographic. you know, and it's going to be heavily age group driven. And there's going to continue to be a mixed landscape out there, and people will continue to try. Producers will continue to try new things to see if they can get to the, you know, the next new thing. But there are going to be things that will happen, like Quarter Life failing on NBC. And then there'll be this, well, see, we told you this is not the way, you know, that people want their content. But again, you know, but it's still being consumed in its alternate platform or in its primary platform and successful. So I think it's just going to continue. It's going to be all about enabling technology and what resonates with the consumer. And from the business side, you know, you look at the way big corporations behave and all the merger and the buyout activity out there, and that's, nobody knows what's going to happen. You know, just the way nobody knows whether a feature film will be successful or not.
The other comment I wanted to make is that there's also a physics of the market. And, you know, the strike was about royalties on multiple platforms and all that. And I am a great sarcastic believer in capitalist markets, that there is that shared experience. And that shared experience helps drive the physics of finding ways to get different IP and creative ideas across medium to different ages. And that's what those big iconic things are in our world. That, hey, did you see this? And did you see that? And even if it's on YouTube, even if you think of those little viral videos that make their way around, they hit everybody. So I think capitalist markets will somehow poorly corrupt us all and find a way to do that for us.
Yeah, and what's really going to determine, you know, how people continue to produce is they vote with their eyeballs and they vote with their dollars. And it's all about this, yeah. You know.
Really briefly, my comment, I was glad to see people suggest story, story, story. I'm a novelist, and I think that your comment about storytelling not keeping up, I found this for a variety of different reasons. One being that our avenue as storytellers to people like you who produce things is usually through agencies, usually through agents. And most of the agents that I talk to have absolutely no clue. And that's part of the problem is that, I mean, look how long it took P.D. James to get to the screen with Children of Men. And you know, that's part of the problem is that people that create story like myself don't have direct access, although I'm beginning to figure out ways around that agency process to get directly to people who can bring that to the screen without having to wait until I'm dead, until someone discovers, you know, that thing. And so I think that that's part of the problem is that there's a great disconnect between people who are making stories now or who are doing the storytelling and the people who can put it in the different media platforms.
Right. And I think that, you know, you're really, you know, talking very much about the Hollywood paradigm, and there are two things in operation there. One is the traditional, you know, quiet desperation of the creative trying to get their project made. And that's been in existence as long as there's been filmmaking. But then also because of the huge production budgets, whether it's a very large game project or whether it's a motion picture. There's so much risk associated with actually putting something in production now that there's an excess of caution, which, you know, which doesn't create the most creative situation.
I think also, honestly, I think that there's an excess of ignorance. And true story, 6 months ago, I was sitting with arguably the most powerful literary agent in Hollywood. And we were discussing YouTube. And I could tell just in my heart that he had not spent a tremendous amount of time on YouTube. And so I said, hey, let's just go look at it. And so the way that he got to YouTube was he'd been to Google. And so he went to Google and he typed in YouTube rather than just typing in YouTube. And it was an epiphany for me. And that this is the level of web literacy, right? It's spooky.
You know, in 1999, Blair Witch Project was an economically successful example of a transmedia interactive experience that had a very successful film component. And it's kind of shocking that the studios like Warner Horizon, they're starting all these digital components. And their funding model is to fund content by the minute, which doesn't account for anything interactive. So what's it going to take to change that? I mean, it's so wrongheaded from the start.
I think it's really going to take, and I'd really like to hear what Joseph has to say about this too. It's really going to take some type of hit, you know, phenomenon that makes an unbelievable amount of money, and then it has to be in some way repeatable. You know, because Blair Witch was such an anomaly at the time. It was, you know, it was unheard of to, you know, to spend that little money on a creative property and have it make that incredible return.
We have 1 minute left.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead. Yeah, so I'm gonna let Joseph. But yeah, it's like everything. It's money. You know, it's what makes money. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, Hollywood, just, you know, in terms of innovating within story, I think Hollywood is massively has an illustrious history. Innovating within the platform, I think I don't have any great high hopes for it happening anytime soon.
Okay, well, my apologies that we ran out of time. I actually had some things I want to get Razi's involved in storytelling and modeling, but I will say thank you for coming. Our email address is up there if you'd like to continue questions offline. And see you later on.